Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, yet another new candidate in the race for California governor. Republican Steve Hilton enters the race. Not a huge surprise. We have the first sit-down interview with him of his campaign. Then we talk to Amy Parnes, who is joining Governor Gavin Newsom's podcast. She wrote this explosive, buzzy, number one New York Times best-selling book, Fight, which I really enjoyed. We'll talk to her about that, talk to her about her interaction with Governor Newsom this week. Really interesting interview she did with him. Plus, we sit down with our longtime analyst here on The Issue Is, Brian Goldsmith, who just recently announced that he is running for office for the first time, running for state senate in California. So we'll hear Brian's first interview of his campaign here on The Issue Is. But let's start with Steve Hilton. This week, I went out to his launch event in Huntington Beach. He drew what he says was 2,000 people. There was a big crowd. It was a very well-produced event. Impressive for the first-time candidate. So we're going to play some of his entry video and talk about Steve Hilton's race for governor.
Steve Hilton, welcome back to The Issue Is. Congrats on the run.
Thank you. First time
on this show as a candidate.
I know. We've been talking over the years, Alex, and it's wonderful to be here.
Not a huge surprise. You've been hinting at this for a long time. But congrats on the run. But ultimately, why did you decide to do this? Because we know the odds for Republicans has not always been great. Why the idea of running?
I love California so much. We've been here since 2012, moved here from England with my family. I've had the opportunity to do amazing things in this state, live the California dream. And in many ways, California inspired me even before we moved here. When I was working back in the day in the British government, preparing our policy plans, it was described by the media as California dreaming, that Steve Hilton's vision for the UK is modeled on California. And once that was true, because we were an inspiration to the world. But now you look at what's happened. We've got the highest unemployment in the country for much of last year, the highest rate of poverty, the worst business climate. People are really struggling. And so over the years, I've been getting involved in those issues. I've been traveling the state for 2 years now, talking to people and families and business owners, just hearing how desperate they are for change. I've been working on the policy ideas. The first thing I did, we talked about it, was try and do something about our housing crisis. Mm-hmm. And as that process went on, it seemed to me that I didn't just want to talk about it, I actually want to do something about it to save California, to restore the California dream and make this state golden again.
For a lot of people that are watch Fox News Channel, they're familiar with you and your story and your show. But a lot of people aren't that are just hearing about you for the first time. So can you tell us a little bit about your background, something you talk about in your campaign commercial?
Yes.
You grew up in the UK. You worked, you said, for David Cameron, the prime minister there. Tell us a little bit about you.
So I've got the accent still. People can see I'm working on that.
Yeah.
But the most important thing people need to understand, I'm a proud American and a proud Californian, too. And that really is the foundation of this, to restore the glory of this beautiful state. My parents, though, are Hungarian. And that's a really important part of my makeup, if you like, because they fled communism in Hungary. They went in search of freedom and ended up in England, and that's where I was born, in a free country. But that was the 1970s in England. It was in a country in real decline, with many of the same kinds of problems that we see here in California. And my earliest political memory was Margaret Thatcher. And she really fought back for freedom and restored the spirit of enterprise in the UK and really got things going. And to me, that's a real inspiration. And looking at it from another point of view, back then in the 70s in England, the UK was known as the sick man of Europe. And I'm afraid to say, when you look at the facts about what's going on in California, in many ways right now, we're the sick man of America. That's what we need to change, because we can't go on like this. I think this is a now or never election for California. We've got to change direction.
I mean, there's a lot of bad things, but there are still a lot of good things. Fifth largest economy in the world, leading the world in technology and entertainment and so much agriculture. I mean, so many things that are also great about the state, which is why I know you want
I'd love to talk about that, Alex, because all those things are true. And I'm incredibly proud of the fact that we're such a dominant economy, the size of our economy. But if you go through each one of those industries, those iconic industries, our innovation economy, our tech industry. It's not creating this new wave of technology, the AI boom, which is fantastic. It's great that we're leading the world. It doesn't create very many jobs, even fewer than the first round of innovation. You look at the entertainment industry here where we're speaking in Los Angeles, leaving the state. You've got film and TV production leaving to other states, other countries. That's taking with it really good jobs. So I think unless we change, and agriculture, my goodness, our farmers, I was in the Central Valley not long ago, fig farmers, fifth generation, and they just can't make it work anymore. It breaks my heart. They're having to leave the state because of the regulations, the water being taken away, the taxes. We got to change direction.
So you know the reality that no Republican has won statewide since 2006. That was Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was the most famous guy in the world and married to a Kennedy Democrat.
That's not me.
So how do you actually do this? How does a Republican win in a state when there's 25% more Democrats registered here?
So I don't actually see it as a partisan thing. As I said today at my event in Huntington Beach, this is not red or blue, it's golden.
Well,
we've got to focus on...
You said that, but then you also had a whole lot of real red people there. I mean, you've got Charlie Kirk, you've got Vivek Ramaswamy, you've got Kevin Kiley, you've got John Voight. I mean, these are Trump MAGA people. Everybody there wearing the Trump hats. I mean, this did not feel like a lot of blue in this event.
But I've been on the road and speaking to Democrats and Republicans alike and independents. Remember, that's a really big group here in California. I think there's an opportunity for a credible candidate who puts forward common sense, practical ideas that aren't ideological. I think that's one of the big problems we've had in California. Too much ideology rather than practical things that actually help people. I think there's a real market for that because people want change. They know we need change. I mean, everyone agrees we need change. The question is, can we put forward a credible, specific plan for how we give people the themes of my campaign, great jobs, great homes, great kids?
Vivek Ramaswamy announced his endorsement for you. Charlie Kirk announced his endorsement for you. Have you asked President Trump for his endorsement?
I have not, and I'm very focused on California, not federal politics, because we've got a lot of problems here, and that's what we need to focus on. That's the whole theme of my campaign. Let's really get to work putting together a movement for change so we can deal with the housing crisis. We have the highest housing costs in the country. That's the number one reason people are leaving California. We got to do something about that.
If he endorsed you, though, you would accept it, right?
Oh, I'd be totally proud to accept the endorsement of anyone who is not just a leader in the Republican Party, but president of our great country. I mean, that would be a great honor. But of course, the interesting thing, if you look at that today, we also had Lan He Chen, who a good friend, someone I've worked with for a while. He ran for state controller a couple of years ago. We had Gloria Romero there, the former Democrat leader of the state Senate. I'm really serious about putting together a broad coalition, nonpartisan, in the sense of common sense solutions that people can agree about that aren't political in the old-fashioned sense. They're just pragmatic and practical.
You talked about the fact that we don't have party primaries anymore running for governor. But if we did, your toughest competitor right now would be Sheriff Chad Bianco. You both are going for Republican votes right now. What's your take on Sheriff Bianco and why you think you're better than him?
Well, I'm going for everybody's support because, as I said, we've got to do this together to make our state what it really should be. I'm focused on the fact that we've got to change direction. And in the end, that means changing from this one part. We had 15 years of one party rule. So I think the purpose of this election is to see who is going to be the best candidate to make that change happen. And I'm going for it, and the sheriff is going for it, and we'll see. I'm focused on making the argument for change and being the best person to credibly offer the
specific
changes.
But why are you better than him?
I wouldn't make the comparison specifically. I would just say I've got a track record of leadership on the issues. Remember, back in the pandemic, when everyone else said, got to shut everything down, I was one of the first people to say no, to stand up against the groupthink and to say we've got to actually open things up, follow the science on so many issues, on our relationship with China. For years, I was arguing about that before people now, there's a consensus about that. On many issues, I've had a leading role, and I think specifically working across a range of policy inside of a government to make change happen.
What about Rick Caruso, who was a Republican, may run as a Democrat? Some might argue that's a better way to win. What do you make of him?
Well, the interesting thing, Alex, about Rick Caruso is it's striking that this is someone who became a Democrat at the height of the far left lunacy that the Democratic Party fell into. Mm. And I just don't understand that. I also don't understand why, when he's making the case, I think very convincingly, that we need a change of leadership here in Los Angeles after the catastrophe of the wildfires and the response, Rick Caruso came out against the recall that myself and Nicole Shanahan, who was Bobby Kennedy's running mate in the presidential election, we've been working together on a recall. Rick Caruso said, no, we don't need a recall. And I just don't understand that. I think that if you really believe in change, you've got to fight for it and argue for it.
Interesting. You talked about during your launch campaign watching our show.
Yes.
And you saw our interview with Javier Becerra.
Yes.
And I talked to him about changes for housing affordability. I don't think you were impressed by his answer where he talked about scrubbing the system.
Yes.
What do you make of him as a competitor and your thoughts on his interview with us?
Well, I think it's astonishing, honestly, that someone who says there, well, first of all, let's remember what he said in his announcement video, which was that the California dream, which was there for his parents, is not there now. He's right. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But who destroyed that California dream? Javier Becerra's party and its policies, because no one else has been around. They've been in charge for 15 years mm-hmm. of one-party rule. So that's the first point. How can the people who made the mess be the ones to clear it up? But secondly, when you asked him about what he says is his number one priority, dealing with the affordability crisis, he just talked basically gibberish. You can't do that. This is serious. This is, as you mentioned, leadership of the fifth largest economy in the world. We've got to have people who understand policy, who understand how to implement policy, and who've got clear ideas for how we get California back on track.
What's the number one thing you would do when it comes to affordability in this state to make things cheaper for
people? The number one thing is to reduce the tax burden on working people. That's the quickest thing we can do to relieve the financial pressure, because it's unbelievable to me that people earning salaries that really don't get you very far in California these days, $70,000, $80,000, let alone below that, are paying state income tax up to 9% plus. So the first part of my plan, Great Jobs, is to take everyone who's earning $100,000 or less out of state income tax. Mm. That's the first step. Secondly, for businesses who are struggling under this incredible burden of regulation, we've got to go back to basics. Sunset all our regulations. So we ask ourselves, do we need any of this stuff that's clogging up businesses? People may say that's difficult to achieve. Idaho did it. When they did it, they cut their regulations by 95%. Mm. On housing, we've got to get away from this situation where we have the highest housing costs in the country. There are specific things we can do there. We've got to cap hidden housing taxes. They're called impact fees. Berkeley Turner Center, UC Berkeley, have estimated that these hidden taxes on housing are up to 20% of the price. We need to cap them. We need to end the anti-housing lawsuits that stop housing being built. We need to stop the regulations that make it so expensive to build.
So we see, though, we have a deficit this year. If you take all those people out of the tax system, how do you make up the revenue?
Well, we need to cut spending. The budget of the state of California, this is an unbelievable number. The budget of the state of California has doubled in the last 10 years.
So what do you cut?
Even after inflation, it's gone up by 50%. Massive bloat in our state government. Mm-hmm. That's where you've got to start. If you're a business today in California, you have got so much coming at you from all these different agencies of the state government. And then you've got regional agencies and local government. We've got to, I mean, look at the salaries people are paid here in Los Angeles. The empty reservoir lady, right? $750,000.
The head of the LADWP.
The DWP.
Ken Yonas.
There's been an enormous inflation in what government costs. And is anything better after all this increase in the spending? Mm. You look at homelessness, where spending has gone up billions and billions of dollars, but the problem's got worse. Mm-hmm. So don't tell me that we can't get the budget back to a reasonable size. By the way, our tax plan to take everyone earning $100,000 or less out of state income tax And the spending reduction that would make that possible, that would take us just back to pre-pandemic spending levels. Mm. This is not some impossible task. This is totally reasonable and practical, and I'm going to get it done.
To do that, though, you may have to defeat Kamala Harris, who is considering running for governor, also considering running for president. You had very strong words about her during your rally this week. What is your basic thought about Kamala Harris and her decision now to potentially enter the governor's race?
So the sad thing for me, watching how she's approaching this, is when you look at all these articles, we get them almost every week now, Kamala Harris seriously considering running and when she might make a decision and so on. When you look at what she, and by the way, it's not her saying, it's her aides on her behalf. All of the things that are being said about why she might run for California governor are not about us or these problems that you and I have been talking about, how to fix the housing crisis or help small business or help our farmers, nothing to do with that. It's all about herself. It's about the fact that she doesn't want her last act in public life to be certifying Donald Trump's presidential election victory, or that she wants to be, she's intrigued, that was the word used, that she's intrigued by being the first female black governor of a state. Now, they may or may not be things that matter to Kamala Harris, but that doesn't matter at all to anyone watching tonight who's struggling to pay the bills. We need a governor who actually understands the real lives of Californians and how they're struggling and suffering and has got concrete plans to do something about it. I haven't seen a sign of that from Kamala Harris.
So you're not concerned about her as a potential competitor?
I'm not at all. I said today, bring it, Kamala. You know, I don't think that she has shown that she's got the seriousness, the policy seriousness, to actually make a difference and to offer the change that we need in California.
So you write an entire book about your policy seriousness called Failure, where you talk about some of the problems here. If you became the governor, you're now working with a heavily Democratic legislature, potentially still a supermajority in both houses. How do you get anything done?
It's a really important point. And the thing I would offer as a perspective is that you mentioned that I worked for David Cameron, a conservative prime minister, but it was a coalition government. Mm. It was two parties working together in partnership, the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrat Party. I was right at the heart of that. I helped negotiate the coalition agreement between the two parties. I literally shared an office in 10 Downing Street with my opposite number from another party, Polly. We had our moments of disagreement, but we worked together to get things done. And I would expect that when I'm elected, the people would have spoken. They would have made clear their desire for change. It would be a political revolution in California. So I would expect the legislature to listen to the will of the people and to work with me to enact the agenda that people voted for.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a huge, huge national story if that were to happen. So we like to end things with something fun here on this show to get to know you. This is our personal issues game. 30 seconds, your cultural favorites. First thing that comes to mind, Steve Hilton, what's your favorite recent TV show that you've seen?
I've actually watched it twice as real light relief from all of this, Four Seasons, Call My Agent. Okay. So this is a show about a talent agency. It's a little bit obscure, I know.
Okay.
It's a talent agency in Paris. It's incredibly funny and brilliant, and I love Paris, so it's a beautiful combination of many things.
What's your favorite band or musician?
There's so many. I love music. My mom was on a video today, and she reminded me, I'd forgotten, that when I was a teenager, my goal in life was to be a DJ.
Right.
So it's very difficult to choose. I love Radiohead. I love the Beatles. I love dance music. I go to Glastonbury as often as I can. It's very difficult to pick one band.
Whatever happened to the DJ thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe if this doesn't work out, Alex, that's where I'm stuck with.
See you mixing some music. Well, thank you for coming on.
Of course.
We got queued up one of your songs.
Okay.
So this is Let the Sunshine In.
Okay, very good.
Our launch event, we saw you dancing to this.
Oh, dear. Well, it's a little, you know.
As we make California golden again.
That's the plan.
Which is your new slogan. Thanks so much, Steve. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Thanks, Alex.
Appreciate it.
Our thanks to Steve Hilton. Now, let's talk to Amy Parnes, the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Fight, about the presidential election. She's a recent guest of Governor Gavin Newsom on his podcast, This is Gavin Newsom. And she also interviewed him with a really interesting piece for The Hill, where Newsom really went after the Democratic Party. So here's our conversation with Amy Parnes.
Joining us now from San Francisco is Amy Parnes. Amy, welcome to The Issue Is for the very first time.
Thank you, Alex. It's nice to be here.
So you were a guest on Governor Newsom's podcast. What was that like?
Pretty wild, just in terms of someone else asking me the questions, someone like him, someone I'm used to interviewing him and other politicians, a little bit strange to have the tables turned and the questions to be posed on me. But I think my co-author and I also tried to ask him a few questions. He was involved in some of the elements we write about in our book. And so we were curious to get his take. And I think it was fascinating to hear him kind of remark about how accurate our reporting was, you know, based on everything he knew.
I mean, your reporting gets into a lot of, you know, dirt and sort of backstabbing in the Democratic Party. What does it say that Newsom would want to highlight that book?
I think he, well, clearly he read it because he was ready to talk about the minutiae of our book. And I think he is also curious as a politician and someone with presidential aspirations, probably, what we gleaned from this book and what we can do looking ahead, you know, what we lay out for future politicians who want to do this. And I think he comes into this with a curiosity more than anything.
So what'd you tell him on that front?
I think we, and he agreed with us on this, we essentially said that the Democratic Party needed to be held accountable for what had happened, that Joe Biden needs to maybe come out, or people close to him need to come out and have honest conversations about what was going on behind closed doors at the White House and what led to the Trump presidency. I think he also thinks that the party obviously is in a little bit of a weird spot right now, doesn't know who it is in an identity crisis, and is trying to figure out what to do. I think he more than most wants to figure out where the party is and how to gain the trust back of voters that the Democratic Party has lost over time.
Yeah, and you interviewed Governor Newsom for The Hill, and he had some pretty strong takes on where the Democratic Party is. What were your main takeaways from that conversation?
I mean, the big thing is that he feels like the party is still trying to figure out where it is, who it is essentially leaderless, rudderless, and doesn't really have an identity right now. And that was really interesting to me because this is someone obviously who is a top contender in 2028, huge name on the national stage, and also is so perplexed about where the party is right now and what it needs to do to get itself out of the wilderness. And, you know, he has some ideas. He said that the party should be doing a really intensive forensic on what went wrong. He says that the party isn't doing that right now. He hasn't been included in that process, which is also pretty amazing and stunning to me, considering that a lot of people look to him as the future of the party. And, you know, he has some other ideas on where the party needs to go from here. But, you know, one of the things that he's trying right now, one of these kind of things that I think is, you know, that he's testing is this podcast. And he wants to invite people like Steve Bannon and Charlie Kirk on, and is sort of, and he acknowledged this, is sort of kicking the tires on that and trying to do a listening tour and see what other people on the other side are offering.
And he acknowledged in your interview that then a lot of people on his side are not liking that.
Yeah, I mean, he said that it's bumpier than he thought it would be. But he also feels the need to not just speak to the chorus and preach to the choir. He wants to kind of reach outside the Democratic universe and reach across the aisle to other people and really listen to what they're saying. I mean, I think a lot of what he was telling me yesterday was, you know, that he wants to have these voices as part of the conversation.
So in Fight, you report on the governor's maneuvers when it looked like President Biden might not be the nominee. So what was he doing privately while telling all of us publicly that he had sub-zero interest in ever being president or even thinking about being president. What was he actually doing?
I mean, I think he was also kind of in listening mode and trying to see where people were. I think he was probably curious about people who, you know, like Nancy Pelosi, like Barack Obama, who didn't think that Kamala Harris could win, and they were kind of testing the idea of an open primary. Of course, I think he denies all of this publicly, but I think, you know, he's a politician and you're running until you're not running. And I think that he was, you know, he was curious about where things were going.
Well, the fact that he brought you onto his podcast or promoting your book and telling you how accurate it is maybe leads you to believe that maybe your reporting was true.
I mean, it was, you know, we knew our reporting. We've always stood by our reporting. But to hear him, who is so, you know, vested in the Democratic Party, so much a part of it, talks to donors, talks to all these players, to hear him talk about how airtight it was gratifying.
So one of the main struggles for the Harris campaign was separating herself from President Biden. But according to your book, he really didn't let her, including right before the debate. What did he tell her?
He essentially told her, no daylight, kid. You know, he calls her in the hours before the debate. She's been practicing. She's been in really knee-deep in prep sessions, really ready to go on this. And here she is, you know, almost spot, and she takes a call from him, and he essentially tells her, no daylight, kid. He knew that she, you know, he kind of warns her that his legacy is on the line. So many questions throughout the election why she's not distancing herself from him. And I think this moment really shed some light on what was happening behind the scenes. And what was interesting is the White House kind of had a different arrangement with members of her campaign. They essentially said, do what you need to do. But the principals, Harris and Biden, had their own sort of separate agreement.
You also talk about Nancy Pelosi's push to get Biden off the ticket and how she didn't believe that Harris would win. She wanted there to be an open primary. Now that everything has happened, and all of that is so public about what Nancy Pelosi did, who likes to do things privately, how do you think all this impacts Nancy Pelosi's legacy?
I mean, I think in a way she was right. You know, she had her finger on the pulse. She was concerned first and foremost about the country and what was going on, you know, losing the presidency, but was also really concerned about the House. And she's hearing from members on both sides of, you know, from her caucus, and they don't want to be out there publicly, but they're concerned about losing the House, and they're telling her as much. And so she's really, I mean, to this day, she denies playing a very public role. If you asked her right now if she played a role in this, she would say absolutely not. But she was there taking calls, taking arrows, you know, talking, doing the dirty work when a lot of people were afraid to do that. I mean, when you look across, you know, from Hakeem Jeffries to Joe Biden and everyone else on board, she was the one who was really doing, you know, every little bit of the dirty work. Barack Obama, too, did not want to get as involved as she did. And so I think at the end, she was sort of justified by everything that she did do.
Joe Biden's whole reason for running in 2020 was to try to stop Trumpism. He didn't do that. Trump is more powerful now than he ever was. And so much of this potentially is his fault. How do you think all of this has changed his legacy?
It's definitely changed his legacy. And, you know, the thing that I'm hearing and my co-author is hearing more than anything from people who read our book is, you know, the amount of concern and anger there is right now, and the arrows directed at Joe Biden for not being candid, and his team for not being candid about what was happening behind the scenes, for, you know, selfishly digging in when they could very well just have walked away and said, you know, he did what he needed to do. He served a term. He's going to pass the torch on to, you know, new leadership in the party. And, you know, he still to this day believes that he is the only one who could have beaten Donald Trump. He did it once, and he still believes that he could have done it a second time. But I do think that, you know, especially since our book, his legacy is really tarnished. And I think other people will have similar things to say as well.
Yeah, we expect a book coming out soon from Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson, which really looks at some of those, what the White House was doing to try to protect him as well. All right, so your book is really like a great political TV show. It takes you inside the room where it happens. To me, there's been like three great political TV shows of our lifetime. There's The West Wing, an idealistic show where the main characters are mostly good in politics, mostly for the right reasons. They do good work. There's House of Cards, a mostly cynical show where the main characters are mostly smart, scheming, corrupt, and a bit soulless. And then there's Veep, a comedy where most of the main characters are bumbling, foolish, and overall incompetent. So which one of these three is closest to the truth?
You know, that's a really good question. I've always felt like there's a combination of all of them that's very realistic. I think House of Cards, it's sinister, but I've seen elements of that. I've seen elements of Veep. And of course, West Wing. But you know, what's interesting and what we've heard about from, you know, readers reading our book is that they think that it does incorporate all of these things. And people, it falls under the category, Alex, of truth is stranger than fiction. Mm. I think like half the stuff that we have in this book reads like fiction, except it happened. Right. And I think all of these shows, these various shows, they kind of find their way into these pages. It's really interesting to see, you know, this is sort of like a Greek tragedy in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of drama and there's a lot of humor in it as well. So it's interesting that you name all of those shows because I thought about all of them as we were writing this book.
That's interesting. So what is your process, though, for reporting to this level? How do you get people to trust you in their most vulnerable moments for you to like have exact quotes of what happened?
I mean, it's really hard. And I think if this was our first rodeo, it would be a lot harder. But thankfully, my co-author and I have written two other campaign books. And that really prepared us for this one when we had a really short runway to write this and report it, mostly reported after the election. So you can imagine what a tight time crunch we were under. And, you know, but gratifying that sources really trusted us over the years to tell their stories. And, you know, we consider this to be among our best work because people took the time to talk to us. They want to get this right for history. It's not just looking back, it's also looking ahead. And so we're really, really appreciative of everyone who trusted us to tell this story.
Well, we end with something fun on this show called Personal Issues. This is 30 seconds of your cultural favorites. Just like Gavin Newsom, I'm turning the tables on you. And so this is what comes to mind, quick answers. So here we go. Amy Parnes, what is your favorite political TV show?
Veep.
Favorite movie?
When Harry Met Sally.
Favorite sports team?
The Dolphins, Miami.
Favorite band or musician?
Oh my gosh, so many, but the Beatles.
What's your favorite meal?
Oh my gosh. My mom cooks a killer Iranian dish.
Okay. And who is your role model?
Role model is my son.
Your son, who is with you right now, right?
With me right now.
And why is he your role model?
He teaches me things every day, things that blow my mind. And you know, it's so counterintuitive, but I learn from him every single day of my life.
Does he want to make a cameo?
Yes, he would love to make a cameo. Come over here.
And what's his name?
Remy.
Was he bored with our interview?
Okay. No, he was listening. He can't believe that he's on. He always wanted to be on TV. Here you go.
There
this
he is.
Remy, my role model.
Oh, that is so sweet. Remy, you want to say something nice about your mom?
I like that she's been writing 4 books.
Okay. Very
and
nice.
And 2 of them got number 1 New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, including this one. Number 1 New York Times bestseller, Fight. Congratulations. Enjoy your time in our golden state of California, Amy Parnes. Hello. And Remy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Amy Parnes. And finally, our conversation with Brian Goldsmith, the longtime analyst here on The Issue Is, who is now a candidate for state Senate. He's trying to replace The termed out Ben Allen in Senate District 24, which goes from Agoura Hills all the way down to Ranchos Palos Verdes, the California coast, out to West Hollywood. Brian talks for the first time of his campaign on TV with us.
Brian, welcome back to The Issue Is, and congrats on the run.
You can see how I've aged over 7 years.
Even though you're older than me, it feels like our son has grown up and is going out into the world. Congratulations. This is wild to do it like this. Why are you doing this?
Because I think we're at an inflection point, not just in Washington, but in California. Obviously, in D.C., Donald Trump is trying to blow up our economy and our government. But in Sacramento, you know, the status quo just isn't working. And I felt that it was time for lots of people, including me, to step up and do something bigger, something larger that could have a more direct impact on crime and homelessness, economic opportunity and affordability, the issues that I hear about all the time.
So what specifically would you do differently in Sacramento? And with that, how would you basically stand up to the Democratic status quo?
Well, I think every legislator brings his own perspective. And mine is we've got to spend our money efficiently and effectively. You know, you've got Elon Musk with his chainsaw, you know, trying to kind of blow up government. Yeah. But then you have a lot of people who've just accepted for too long the way things are, where we've spent, you know, $20 billion on homelessness without meaningfully improving the situation, wasted $20 billion on EDD fraud, driven a bunch of programs that aren't producing results. And so my perspective is going to be to look at everything fresh, and what's working, you double down on it. What isn't working, you get rid of. And I think it takes an outsider sometimes to have that perspective.
We know there is so much entrenched power for special interests in Sacramento. There's a reason why a lot of that is set up the way that it is. How would you do that? How would you fight your own party, fight the interests to get that done?
Well, I'm fighting MAGA and the Republicans, I think, a lot more than I'm fighting my own party. But, you know, I'm coming into this not as somebody who's ever run for office, not as somebody who's dependent on any one special interest, but I want to build coalitions. I want to build consensus, and I believe I can. I think that there is a new understanding right now that government has to operate differently, and I represent, even though I'm getting a little older, a new generation of leaders coming in who, you know, with a new governor, a new budget situation, a new political situation, I think we'll look at problems and solutions a little bit differently.
Certainly a different generation than Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
That's safe to say.
So if affordability is the biggest issue for people, how do we make life cheaper?
Well, we've got to make it easier to build here. We've got to make it easier to operate a small business here. We've got to make it easier for people to buy the everyday necessities. That means fighting the Trump administration on tariffs, which will raise the price of everything. But it also means here at home, simplifying processes, lowering fees, looking at, you know, for example, what Josh Shapiro has done in Pennsylvania, what Jared Polis has done in Colorado, to operate government differently, to think of citizens a little less like subjects and a little more like customers. Mm. We're the technology capital of the world. We should be using AI to drive better customer service. We should be results and outcome oriented, not as process driven.
Sounds like a pro-business Democrat.
Well, I'm pro-business and I'm pro-labor. I think that's a false choice. I mean, I think that working men and women in this state have a real problem making it. You know, a middle-class income in California no longer provides a middle-class life. And I think government has to be really focused on improving the quality of life for everyday Californians.
What's it like doing this on this side? I mean, you've come here, you talk so much about everybody else, it's easy to talk about everybody else. What's it like now being the guy yourself after telling everybody all the advice for all these years?
Well, I mean, it's a little different. It's a little bit like the lawyer representing himself, you know, with a fool for a client. But, you know, there are parts of it I really like, getting the chance to dig in and think about policy. There are parts of it I like less. Asking all my friends for money
right.
is a new feeling.
Seems
and
awful.
Not a great one.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it is kind of nice to be on my own two feet, to be independent, and to tell people what I really believe.
And are some of the people you used to give advice to now giving you advice?
Yes, of course.
And what are people telling you?
Well, plastic surgery, you know, you've got a face for podcasting. People are giving me all sorts of advice. But I've been around this business long enough, both as a journalist and advising other Democrats, to kind of know that authenticity is really the coin of the realm. I've got to be who I am. And, you know, I've got to do this my own way.
Part of that is answering honestly when we do personal issues on this show, which I know you've seen many, many times over the years. So now it's your turn to do the hot questions. Brian Goldsmith, what's your favorite TV show?
Succession.
Great. Favorite movie?
The Godfather.
Great choice. Favorite band or musician?
Recently, Taylor Swift.
Really?
Original, yeah, my daughter's got, I have an 8-year-old daughter. God. She's gotten me really into
it. Okay, favorite sports team?
Dodgers, of course.
Favorite Taylor Swift song?
Oh my God, that's a tough one. A lot to choose from.
Cruel Summer, okay.
Yeah.
Who is your role model?
My role model, in a lot of ways, my grandfather. You know, because he died about 9 years ago, and there's rarely a day that goes by when somebody doesn't come up to me and tell me about something wonderful he did for them in their lives, how much they miss him. He just had a profound effect on a lot of people in small ways, never asked for credit or recognition, but just extraordinary character.
Tell us a little bit about him.
He came to LA in 1952. From Chicago, woke up to a sunny day, it was 70 degrees, and thought he had arrived in paradise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he had lost a lot of family in Europe in the Holocaust. His parents were immigrants, and he built an extraordinary career here in LA, and he always credited, you know, luck in this city and this state as much as his own talent for his success.
What do you think he would think of you potentially being in the state Senate?
What are you, crazy? No, I think he'd like it.
Congratulations on the run.
Thank you.
We're proud of you. I know we don't get to endorse candidates here, but we endorse all you've done for our show over the years and your great kindness and professionalism.
Thank you, my friend. And what you've done for the state in providing a forum for this kind of political conversation is critically important. So thank you, too.
Look at him already learning how to suck up as a politician.
I've been sucking up to you for years.
All right, Brian.
Our thanks to Brian and to Amy Parnes and to Steve Hilton and to you for listening. I'm Alex Michelson. We'll see you next time for more of The Issue Is. In the meantime, like, subscribe, all the things. Love to hear from you in social media at Alex Michelson. Thanks so much.